Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week, what happens when philosophers, or at least people with ideas, engage with the world of real politics? We're dealing with two such people this week. One is an Australian philosopher who's been helping out the Prime Minister of Spain. The other was an Italian whose literary career was glorious, but whose political career was perhaps a little less wonderful. His name was Niccolò Machiavelli, and he lived in Florence from 1469 to 1527. To learn about him, I spoke to Bill Kent, Professor of History at Monash University and General Editor of the Letters of Lorenzo de' Medici, who, as we shall find out, was no friend of Machiavelli. To begin with, Machiavelli was a Republican. But what did it mean to be a Republican if you were a 15th century Florentine?
He wasn't obviously a Republican in the sense that Mr. Bush is a Republican or Mr. McCain is a Republican, nor in the modern sense say that Mr. Rudd wishes we were or anything of the sort. He was a Florentine Republican of a very particular late 15th century stamp. Florence had been a republic since the 12th, 13th century, and in a sense it was a rare bird by the time he was born, 1469. That is to say, Europe was, Italy was, basically monarchical, princely, was going to remain so for the next 200 or 300 years. Ancien regime, if you like. But a few of these medieval republics, Florence, Venice, Lucca, a few in Germany, a few in Switzerland, had survived. And he had in mind the republicanism of these small but very interesting city-states. They're not democracies, it's important to say. In an infamous law, they said that women, children, peasants and idiots couldn't vote. I mean, there was nothing. They weren't democracies in any modern sense. But they were amazingly open to artisans and to ordinary men of a certain kind in a way that no other regime at the period was. So he was a republican in that sense. He believed in the male egalitarian Republic of Florence in the late 15th century. Say 3,000 or 4,000 men with effective political power of some sort or other.
But in fact, that was not the political reality of the Florence in which he lived, was it?
No, it was not indeed. My own view is that, though indeed the place was still technically and constitutionally a republic, the Medici family from 1434 onwards had in effect become party bosses of it. I mean, it was indubitably constitutionally still a republic, but that constitution had been manipulated and changed, always legally or apparently legally, so that in effect, especially by his time, 1469, Lorenzo de' Medici comes into power about then, in effect the Medici and their amici, they called them, their friends, in fact dominated the republican constitutional instruments. So it's a kind of, well, they would have said at the time it was a signorial state in all but name.
And was he one of the Amici?
No, not indeed, at all. The Machiavelli, very interesting family, 12th, 13th century origin, about the same age as the Medici, old, if you like, merchant aristocrats. But they, in the 15th century, were not particular friends of the Medici. They weren't enemies, but they weren't friends. His father, Bernard, has left a very interesting diary in which he really was a retiring urban lawyer, in a way a quite modest figure, not in any sense one of the power brokers, the pizzi grossi, a modern Italians would call them.
But he did have, Machiavelli did have, didn't he, a public career?
He did indeed, but that is post the overthrow, or the first overthrow of the Medici. The Medici were overthrown in 1494, and quite a radical republic is reborn, with Savonarola's influence and so on, the Dominican friar. There, thousands and thousands of ordinary men were able to participate in political decisions. In other words, when I said that there was a republican facade under the Medici, there was obviously people underneath who wished to be republican in that old sense. And that all breaks loose again after 94. And Machiavelli's political career, he's really a civil servant, is from 1498 to 1512, when the Medici come back again. So he actually works for, first of all, the radical republican regime, and then a more moderate republican regime.
Now, we should just say that Savonarola, as you say, the Dominican friar, he really is a radical figure, isn't he? You could see him almost as a proto-Protestant in ecclesiastical terms, but he's also famously urging the Florentines to burn their vanities, so a lot of works of art, which he regards as vanities, are burnt, and of course he ends up being burnt himself.
He does indeed. He wasn't actually theologically, I don't think we'd say, proto-Protestant, really, but in a way it's a late medieval critique of the church. But it's very, very radical. It's the burning of vanities, and of course it goes with a radical republicanism. He said that the good citizen was a good Christian, and the good Christian had to be a good republican. And this was, in a way, a rather 13th century or early 14th century formulation brought back in an age of burgeoning princes. So it was incredibly radical in the context that he was making those statements in.
Is that where Machiavelli stands, or is that too extreme for him?
No, he's not as extreme as that. There was two sorts of republican sentiment around at that time. There was the people who believed in what they called the governo stretto, that is, tight republican government. And that really meant some oligarchs more or less benignly ruling on behalf of the people. And then there was governo largo, broad republican government, and Machiavelli believed in that. I suppose Savonarola believes in an extreme version of governo largo, of a very broad government. Machiavelli, of course, rather despised Savonarola, because he said, of course, that he was a prophet without arms, without force. And Machiavelli believed, above all else, that a city-state, or any regime for that matter, had to have armed citizens and armed strength to survive. What he found foolish in a way, pathetic in a way, about Savonarola was that Savonarola simply preached, and that wasn't enough.
There's a famous passage in his writing after he had failed in his public career when he writes, "When evening comes, I return to my home and I go into my study, and on the threshold I take off my everyday clothes, which are covered with mud and mire. I put on regal and curial robes, and dressed in a more appropriate manner, I enter into the ancient courts of ancient men and am welcomed by them kindly, and there I taste the food that alone is mine and for which I was born, and there I am not ashamed to speak to them, to ask them the reasons for their actions, and they in their humanity answer me, and for 4 hours I feel no boredom." Those were the circumstances, were they, reflecting on the past, in which he writes what in many respects is a rather radical and one would have thought not republican work, his most famous book, The Prince.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad you mentioned the passage. I was trying to find it frantically this morning in my library in case we needed to read it, because it's a wonderful passage. He's writing, it's a letter, of course, to his friend Vettori, and it's in a way, a rather theatrical way, but a sincere enough way, I think, an account of the way he is thinking about writing this radical new book, namely The Prince. Of course, the passage goes on not just that he doesn't fear boredom, he says he doesn't fear, as I recall, death and doesn't fear pain, because he's just been tortured by the new Medici regime. Not terribly badly by the standards of the time, but badly enough. 2.5 turns of the rope, and he complains in the same period about sore shoulders and sore arms and so on. So he's just been tortured by his own city, as it were, and he retires to the countryside and, as he says, he gambles during the day, he talks to peasants. But at night, mud-bespattered, he comes home. And what he means, of course, is that he dresses up and reads the classics. He interrogates the classics of ancient Rome and elsewhere, to find out where Florence should go from here. You're quite right, of course, he does come up with what seems to be, given that he is genuinely a republican, there's no doubt about it, an astonishing conclusion. That is, that the future is with the prince, and that perhaps even Italy can be united against the barbarians, he means, of course, the invading French and Spanish, by a Medici prince.
Well, let's look at the character of the prince for Machiavelli. The prince is presumably nominally Christian, but forgiveness is not his business, unless forgiveness is politically useful for him. The prince for Machiavelli is a pretty determined and ruthless character, isn't he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's absolutely what he's about. He may or may not be Christian. That would almost be, according to Machiavelli, a matter of his private concern. He must use Christianity or not use it as the circumstances and as fortune, chance dictates. His major quality is, of course, this famous Machiavellian notion, well, actually a lot of people at the time held it as well, of virtù, spelt V-I-R-T-U with an accent in Italian. It has very little to do with our virtue, though it is the same word. It means actually virility, the qualities of strength, manliness, balls, if you wish to be vulgar, quite literally. It does mean that sort of thing. And the prince had to have virtù, and that meant he had to be ruthless if he judged that that's what kept his state together. It was about the security of the state that mattered most.
What about fortuna? I mean, is fortuna just fortune, a sort of blind, random goddess who governs the world, or can you make your own fortune?
The 15th century had had a much more optimistic view of fortuna. There she had been a goddess, usually a pagan, depicted as a pagan, naked pagan goddess, whom you could actually woo, seduce, persuade. Actually, because of the sad events of Italy after 1494, foreign invasion, internecine war and so on, in a way a more pessimistic view of fortuna becomes prevalent. And though you can still beat fortuna, according to Machiavelli's generation, you've got to do it by force, if you like, and by guile. And he says in The Prince, in effect, that to beat her you have to, in effect, subdue her. Read almost rape for that, and feminist historians have interpreted that in that way. He also says fortune is a raging river that one can't control. So, yeah, you can control fortune, but only a very tough guy can, and that guy is the prince.
Now, the prince was dedicated, wasn't it, to Lorenzo de' Medici?
The younger, yeah.
Do we know whether it went down well?
Not particularly well, we don't think, no.
But we do know about the long-term reception of the book, which was to blacken his name for centuries, wasn't it?
Absolutely. He becomes Old Nick. He becomes, to the Elizabethans, he becomes Machiavelli. And we still say Machiavelli, meaning somebody incredibly ruthless, amoral, and so on. Machiavelli himself, of course, was an immensely witty, charming, and in his way moral man in all sorts of ways. But the reputation, yes, was blackened for a very long time.
And not helped by the fact that Hitler was said to have had a copy of The Prince by his bedside. I find this hard to believe, but certainly...
I read that, but Frederick II of Prussia certainly did. Mussolini, we know, did, as you would expect an Italian. Then Gramsci on the left read him. And lots of 20th century figures had read Machiavelli.
And Mussolini, in fact, wrote an introduction to The Prince, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's still very shocking when students... When we ask them to talk about Machiavelli, we often suggest they don't read all the accounts of Machiavelli, just go and read The Prince. It's a short book, and it's still an incredibly powerful book and shocking book, even today.
Professor Bill Kent of Monash University on the shocking Niccolò Machiavelli. On ABC Radio National, you're with The Philosopher's Zone, and we're turning now to a Republican thinker who's had a rather more successful time in the world of politics. He's Philip Pettit, formerly of the Australian National University, now Lawrence S. Rockefeller University Professor of Politics and Human Values at Princeton University, and the author in 1997 of a book called Republicanism. And it was that book which brought him to the attention of the Spanish Prime Minister José Luis Zapatero. It started in 2004, when Pettit was invited by Zapatero to give a lecture to a large invited audience in Madrid, with the Prime Minister seated next to him on the dais. So, when I spoke to Philip Pettit recently, I thought it important to establish that he is still a philosopher, isn't he? Not a political advisor or an intellectual at court.
Absolutely not. I remain entirely an academic philosopher.
Now, it's not unknown for politicians to have, if this doesn't sound too condescending, pet intellectuals who sort of decorate the political landscape for them, but it's rather less common for the politicians to be either willing or capable of taking these intellectuals seriously. I mean, we all remember that the British government in 1997 said it was going to have an ethical foreign policy, and I think a lot of people would say that this wasn't very clearly in evidence. So did you have reasons to think that Mr. Zapatero was taking you very seriously?
I think the word you're not using, Alan, is the word spin. I mean, so that's always the danger in a case like this, that a public figure takes up an academic philosophy or a tradition of an intellectual kind like this and basically just uses it, as you put it nicely, to decorate the position. That was a real concern of mine, because I felt that Tony Blair in Britain actually had, well, to put it crudely, taken some intellectuals rather for a ride. I mean, it seemed to me they began to look silly in a way, as he interpreted their principles in just any old way. I was very anxious as a result in the 2004 lecture to spell out pretty exactly the sorts of policies I thought that these principles, the civic republican principles, would require. And in the course of the lecture, I turned to him. He was on the dais with me. And I said, you know, it was sort of meant to be an amusing remark, and it did actually rouse some mirth in the audience. I said, look, Mr. President, you're going to find it extraordinarily difficult to live up to some of these principles. They sound very fine, and it's very easy for me as a philosopher to spell them out, but it's much, much more difficult for a practicing politician. And the remarkable thing was he was visibly fired up by this challenge as he saw it. And in his reply to me, he, I think, put aside what he had meant to say in favor of asserting that he was absolutely committed to the general principles and the more particular policies supported in this tradition. And he then invited me publicly, which completely threw me, to come back in 3 years' time, 6 months before the next election, and review his performance in government for how far I thought it had been faithful to this tradition.
Now, perhaps we should look at these ideas to which he has laid claim, the civic republican tradition. What does that amount to? What does it mean?
Well, historically, as you well know, it derives mainly from, it's associated with the Roman Republic, and sometimes is called sort of neo-Roman or whatever, republicanism. There are really two core ideas in the tradition, I would say. One is a particular conception of freedom, which in fact is what my 97 book was focused on articulating. Under this conception of freedom, it's not enough to just be let alone, not to actually be interfered with. In order to be free, you mustn't be under, as the phrase used to be, you mustn't be under anyone's thumb. You mustn't have any overlord. You mustn't have anyone in your life who could interfere did they happen not to like what you were doing. You have to, in other words, be free of, well, the old Latin word was free of a dominus, meaning a master. And consequently, I use the word in articulating this approach to freedom as the phrase freedom as non-domination. You had to not have a master in your life, be that master, you know, a husband, a father, a bully in the family, a workplace bully, a union for that matter, an overweening union, or an employer or a manager. Or be it somebody of a different ethnic group, if you're in an ethnic group that is subject to that sort of exposure to, as it were, interference at will, arbitrary interference on the part of other people. Well, in this tradition, it's very important to insist that you're not free if you live in the power of such a person, even if it's a purely kindly person.
Now, there is a tradition of this thought. You mentioned Roman thought. There's a tradition of this thought, obviously, in classical literature. It also emerges in the Italian Renaissance, and we then find it in English thinking in the 17th century, and most notably in American thought at the time of the Revolution, the War of Independence. Is there any tradition of this in Spain, or is it completely new to them?
You've done a very nice summary sort of history there, Alan. I entirely agree with it. It is this long tradition that weaves its way around different European countries and into the American Revolution. In Spain, there's a tradition of 19th century republicanism. But one of the problems, and indeed it's a problem with the word republicanism, is that while the approach was firmly focused on enabling people to live outside the power of any master, it became focused in particular on the danger of having an absolute king, because an absolute king, a king who wasn't constitutionally bounded or limited, a king who was above the law in the image, for example, of the 17th century Spanish or French kings, such a king was the very embodiment of a dominus, a lord in your life, someone who had arbitrary power, who might be very nice, a benevolent despot perhaps, but who just could interfere with anybody more or less at will. That became the emblematic expression of what it is to have a dominus or a lord. And so republicanism, as the term became used more and more popularly, particularly into the 19th century, came to signify opposition to having a king. And of course, that very easily generalized even to opposition to having a constitutional monarch. So it came to be known more mainly as a doctrine of anti-monarchicalism, which is indeed how it's still commonly known, the word. So I would say that republicanism in the 19th century was certainly very popular in Spain. And of course, the government that fell to Franco was a republican government, as it was self-described. but it was Republican, not, I would say, in a very distinctive sense associated with this tradition, more in that general sense of not being monarchical.
Well, now, how does Zapatero's government shape up after a few years, according to your ideas of how it should be working?
The review is really pretty positive. I mean, I do insist that I actually had only met Zapatero on two occasions prior to giving the lecture. One of them was a long interview, getting details from him about what he had done. But I was in no way, so to speak, party pris with Zapatero. I was indeed always afraid that he might prove to be a politician of spin. The bottom line I reach in the review is that this is really quite an extraordinary government, and he's been an extraordinary president who, time and again, with various pieces of legislation, has followed through on what I would see as the roughly the sorts of policies supported by this Republican or civicist tradition. The idea would be, in the ideal, that government would protect citizens or establish a culture that would help to protect citizens against private domination in their lives by other citizens or by corporations, by other groups, by churches for that matter, unions or whatever. But that in protecting people against such private domination, it wouldn't itself represent a form of public domination. I'm probably going on too long on this, but if I can look very briefly at each of those and I can give you an idea of what Zapatero has done that did impress me.
Yes, yeah, please do.
Okay, so on the private side, in his interview with you, I remember he, when I was following through with him about what he had done in government about a year before I gave the lecture, he said to me, "Who are the most dominated people on earth?" And then answered the question, as he said, "Women, women, women." And it's very striking that some of his early, much of his legislation has been focused on, as he sees it, empowering women against an arbitrary power in their lives. So, for example, one of his first pieces of legislation was a law against gender violence, which, for good or ill, has been associated, rightly or wrongly, with a sort of Hispanic tradition. And he's, you know, been absolutely to the forefront in establishing legislation in this area. He also introduced a law of dependency, giving assistance to the disabled and to those, mainly women, who've got to stay at home and take care of the disabled. It's a second bit of legislation. A third is a law of equality, which seeks to establish conditions where women are able to play an equal part with men in public life and in the workforce. So, for example, this law requires political parties to have at least 40% women on their electoral lists. And he himself, in his cabinet, it's always had 50% women. It also requires companies employing over 250 people to introduce equality plans aimed at eliminating discrimination against women in pay or promotion or benefits of any kind. So that's just one example, legislation in regard to women, where he has taken the Republican idea of it's being important that people do not stand in the power of another. They do not live in the old phrase in potestate domini, in the power of a master, and has applied it to women. He's also, and this is all in the area of protecting against private domination, he very much forefronted his law of homosexual marriage, as it's called, under which it's possible for homosexual couples to marry in the full sense of marriage, not just in a sense of civil union. And interestingly, in introducing this in Parliament, he actually used a sort of trope from the Republican tradition, which you often get, which is you're not free unless you can look others in the eye fearlessly and without deference. He's also, there are all sorts of other pieces of legislation. It's a remarkably active government, actually, in protecting against private domination. For example, amnesty for illegal workers, introducing protections against temporary contracts that had been much abused in commercial life in Spain, and a variety of other things of that sort. That's the protection against private domination. So it's been a very active government, and it's been very explicit. Zapatero has been very explicit in invoking the civic republican idea of freedom as non-domination, no dominación, as they say in Spain. It's become a sort of byword almost in supporting this legislation.
Philip Pettit on Philosophy in Action. The show is produced by Kyla Slaven, with technical production this week by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online. with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.